practice period is also kind of like that. It's kind of like forgetting to count yourself.
We're so concerned with taking care of others that we forget that we're here too. Forget all about ourselves. So it's getting cooler as the fall comes, but it's very warm in here with all of us. And we practice period for see some new faces. You might wonder what this is all about. So it's just a 9-week time to focus more intently and in a committed way to Zen practice in all its forms and manifestations. And so we begin tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock with Sesshin, 5-day Zen retreat, gathering the mind, collecting the mind into present awareness of what's happening. Again, very much together practice. Silent, but very intimately woven together. And then we'll have various events during these 9 weeks, like a class series. The Shuso, the head student, Niyati, will offer tea and discussion on Sunday evenings. And we'll finish the practice period with another 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin to celebrate Buddha's awakening in December. So many of you have made particular commitment to some part of the practice period. It's a self-designed event. We have all these different aspects of practice period, and people say, for these 9 weeks, I want to decide that I will practice like this, and I will probably resist it at times, but I'm going to see how it is to work with that resistance, to kind of make a decision and then follow through even if we don't feel like it. That's one aspect of Zen practice. Sounds kind of strange, but it's beautiful. Yeah. To go along supporting practice and supporting the group. Not so much dependent on our particular emotion or state of mind on the particular day. Regularity of practice. 28 people made some commitment to this practice period. That's so encouraging to me. Maybe double the size of the last practice period. And it's all, you know, some people are coming to up to 10 periods of Zazen a week. Some are coming to 2. Some are coming to the classes, some are not. But everybody, depending on their life circumstances, is taking up some practice for this particular period of time. It's nice, I think. It's an ancient tradition to have these particular periods of time. It goes back to the Buddha's day in India, where they had certain seasons and times with beginnings and endings where they would focus more intently as a group together. And Sesshin, these next 5 days, you can, if you've signed up, you already know what you're doing. If not, we're leaving kind of open times. You're welcome to drop in for morning or afternoon Dharma talks. We have early morning sitting. We have evening sitting from 7:30 to 9. The schedule will be posted. And if you're not doing whole days, we ask people not to participate in the formal meals, Oryoki style meals in the Zendo, but you can come to Zazen and talks. Also, we have a practice during practice period, but throughout the year, called Dokusan, which means an individual meeting, one-on-one meeting. Which we could interpret Zen flavor by saying it's actually just one person meeting. It's not really two people meeting. There's just one mind that appears temporarily as two people having a conversation. So during the practice period, particularly during Sesshin, and other people offer Dokusan also, so they might have a different feeling about this, and they can talk to you about what they would like. But I thought, let's particularly for Sesshin, but maybe for the practice period too, think of Dokusan as a way to like a really focused kind of conversation. I myself am not so skillful at keeping the conversation really present and focused, because it's nice to hang out and chat about all kinds of stuff, but it's just a wonderful opportunity to have a kind of a special type of conversation that maybe we wouldn't have over tea outside at Starbucks or something. A time to, and sometimes we say not necessary to think about anything before you come in, but I think sometimes that can go too far the other way, so that people aren't even like, oh okay, Dokusan, okay, so we get inside now. Let's see what's happening. I think there's some value to actually having an intention, maybe for these conversations. It could be really open, anything about your practice. But I think sometimes Dokusan tends to be tends to have a lot of like extra kind of storyline going on. Like, you know, yesterday I was doing this and I had this conversation with this person, and then it was like, and then this happened. A lot of kind of narrative events are recounted that maybe are not really the focal point at hand. Sometimes we need to do that to bring up the focal point, but I just like to encourage people to you kind of zoom in on a focal question or issue or something about your practice that you'd like to bring up in that special kind of setting of Dokusan, and kind of like kind of get right to the point. There are some traditions that have that do koan practice in Dokusan, and that's, I think, quite a different style. Our Shuso is very familiar with that mode of Dokusan, where it's very short, like minutes long, and it's just very focused on the on a particular koan that you're already working with, and you just present as succinctly and wholeheartedly and presently as possible your response to a Zen story. So it's possible to do that, but since we're not working in the kind of classical way with koans, so something in that spirit of what's the issue at hand? What's the pivot point of my practice this week or this moment? Or this year. And I think that just, I offer that as encouragement to just bring the conversation very alive in the present in such a way. So let's play with that, especially during Sesshin. also during Sesshin, and this would apply for people who aren't in Sesshin, or just any time, I think an aspect of Zen practice is really just harmonizing with the whole group. And you can do this in a way where nobody even knows it's Zen practice in the workplace or when you're shopping or whatever. Notice how you are in relation to other people. So in Sesshin, we really try to emphasize silence. Let's have that be one of our main practices. Especially, you know, of course, that's easy during Zazen, but outside, you know, during breaks and during cleanup and during work periods, we tend to, especially as the days go on, mention a few little things, and then we just get back into our usual habit of discussion, which of course there's nothing wrong with. It's beautiful to meet each other through words, but we just have this special chance in Sesshin to meet in the silence. And can we be like, for example, working in the kitchen together, cleaning the dishes, maybe five people packed into a little kitchen, each one noticing where the other's bodies are, moving around them carefully. That's what I mean by harmonizing with others. And without even having to say anything. You know, maybe occasional, like, do you know where this plate goes? And then that cabinet. And then that's it, instead of like, oh yeah, I was wondering where it went. This cabinet's kind of full though. I wonder if maybe eventually we could think about moving it somewhere else. Like that whole part, you know, not necessary. After Sesshin, you know, could make a list of cabinet rearrangements or whatever. And thinking about, as you get used to the Zen Sesshin style, thinking about the next thing that's going to come. And I think often we have a style, we have a tendency that even if we've been to a lot of Sesshins, we're kind of like waiting for the next person to do the next thing. We're kind of pretty sure what the next thing is, but like there must be somebody else who's actually going to let me know. But often not. If nothing happens, you know, eventually I or the Eno or someone will let the group know. But you can take on the responsibility for if you think you know, you're pretty sure what the next thing to do is, go for it. Like, for example, I just recall one time when there's often some hesitation in Sesshin is just after we finish services, chanting, and then we sit right down for Orioki meal. And sometimes there's kind of, maybe the first day that the Eno kind of helps see people. I don't know how necessary, maybe good, like the first meal to kind of get situated. And then we could say that's kind of your general place. It's not that important where people sit. It's nice to have people newer to that practice sitting with people more experienced. So but maybe you can kind of sense that on your own and just right after service, just go right to your seat and take a seat. And times like that. There's two little bells at morning service to sit down, and often, I don't know, maybe no one remembers, but sometimes it might be like, I can imagine the thought going through a person's mind of, isn't that the sit down bell? But no one's sitting down, so it must not be yet. That's the time. Take it up. Just go for it. It might even be wrong, but you kind of, it's this kind of dance, right, of kind of leading and following at the same time is the harmonizing in Sesshin. And you, again, you can do this at the supermarket. A little different style, but like I like to, at the supermarket, while the person is, the checkout person is ringing up items, I like to just start, take the initiative and just start bagging the items myself. Often people just wait, like, well, it's their job, they'll do it. And I'm just standing here, and then it actually keeps the whole line, the people waiting in line, it's very nice for them because they can just jump right into the next, start buying their groceries. So, and it might be like, well, maybe I shouldn't really take the bag. It's not really given to me, right? But I think it's okay. Or if you have your own bag or whatever. Keeping the, harmonizing with the flow, helping each other out. You know, if you notice the hot water pot for coffee and tea is empty, you're the last person, instead of thinking, well, somebody must be responsible for filling this, so they'll do it. You could, like, probably nobody is. You could just, again, just something that would make it easier for others. I recall a lot of these little things. Practicing in Japan and the monastery, people are really good about this. They have, someone leaves their shoes and it's like a little bit off, scattered because they just rush into the zendo. Someone will kind of straighten them out, or even go so far as to, like, they stepped out of their shoes this way and they'll kind of secretly turn them around to make it easier for the person to step into them if they come out of the zendo. And no one notices except the person coming out. They might not even know if they did it themselves. But making things more smooth and easy and for the next person in these little ways. You can be creative with it. They'd like to bring up tonight about practice period or anything you'd like. Yes.
I always forget what that
means,
the translation.
Oh yeah. Thank you. This is this sesshin starting tomorrow. Sesshin means literally like gathering the mind, gathering the heart. Into one pointed presence, and we call this one Denkoe Sesshin. Denko means transmission of light, and A means like assembly, or gathering. So it's the Sesshin to investigate these stories in the record of transmitting the light, the Denko Roku, which is a important Soto Zen text by Keizan Zenji in the 13th and 14th century he lived. One of the early founders of our tradition in Japan, and one of the I think we could say one of the two most important books of Soto Zen. Dogen, our other founder, wrote The Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, maybe more well-known and very long series of Zen essays. And Keizan, a couple of generations later, wrote and actually he spoke and it was written down. They were Dharma talks that were recorded. This life is the stories, little life stories, but particularly focusing in on awakening stories of the ancestors in our Zen lineage, starting with Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha in India, through 28 generations of Indian ancestors, and a bunch of Chinese ancestors up to Dogen and Dogen's student. So just about up to Keizan, that one who collected it, just about up to his teacher. So it's particularly praised as demonstrating the style of our particular school and lineage of Zen, which is unique in many ways. The Denko Roku. So we've done these sesshins, I think, a couple years now. It's maybe the third year. And so we're just beginning where we left off a year ago. So we start at the story of Dongshan, which is one really important ancestor. Soto Zen is named after two ancestors, Sozan and Tozan. And Tozan is exactly the same as Dongshan. Start with the story of the toe, Soto, the big toe. About the teaching of the insentient, non-sentient beings teaching Dharma is the story in Dongshan's life. It was really important for him. Those are some insentient beings. Walls, tiles, and pebbles are in fact teaching the Dharma right now. Any other particular? Well, since we have a few more minutes, let me just briefly mention in celebration of Zen. Since we're starting a Zen practice period, this is something I heard at a recent meeting. Both Jean and I went up to a conference of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association up at Great Vow Monastery in Oregon. And many discussions and talks and conversations were had up there, and one of them was a Zen scholar named Dale Wright gave a presentation on the strengths and weaknesses of Soto Zen. And I think we could say Zen in general as a spiritual tradition within the larger tradition of Buddha, Dharma, and within the larger tradition of world religion. What are the strengths and weaknesses of Zen? So this was just a nice reflection on this. So if you're new to Zen, here's some celebrations of Zen style that's kind of unique to Zen style. He tried to select these. You could write your own list, but I thought it was pretty good what he came up with. So somewhat briefly here, the 11 strengths of Soto Zen were first, all the just basic Buddhist practices Zen includes, like mindfulness, concentration, presence, compassion, kindness, carefulness, all those great things we can think of about practice. Of course, Zen has those. That's the kind of general category. Second strength is Zen tradition particularly takes practice very seriously. There are Buddhist traditions and other spiritual traditions that are, you know, maybe study a lot and, have a lot of things that they do that aren't necessarily engaging in the actual practice itself. So Zen tradition has always been known for its strong emphasis on actually putting into practice the teachings and many things that we do, particularly Zazen is our kind of central heart practice. We do a lot of this sitting Zazen. We don't just talk about Zazen. Even if we don't know quite what it is, we still come and actually plunk our bottom on a cushion and do it that's a strength of Zen. Thirdly, Zen teaching applies to everything. Some religious traditions might be very focused on the particular religious practices, but they stay within the religious container somehow. But Zen has always been known from the beginning to be applied to our whole daily life. We have specific practices like Zazen, but we understand that to be, it's not just in and of itself. It's like you take that mind of Zazen into your whole life. It applies to everything, not just in the temple, what he called the kind of depth dimension. Fourth is that Zen rejects what he called otherworldliness. It's very down to earth. Within the Buddhist tradition and within other spiritual traditions, we talk about having tea and eating rice as the heart of Zen practice. Chopping wood and carrying water, right? These classic Zen sayings that are about very ordinary activity. And many of the Zen stories, the koan stories, are about very ordinary events. We celebrate the non-duality of samsara and nirvana, which is a big topic that we won't get into now, but that's based on, okay, or we could say the celebration of the ordinary is based on this teaching of the non-duality of the mundane samsaric world and the ultimate truth of nirvana, perfect freedom. Fifth, Zen has no list of required beliefs. Kind of nice. You can believe anything you like, or nothing. I mean, there is, I think we could find, you know, admonitions, plenty of them in Zen, about do it like this, and don't do it like that, and we can find beliefs, but you don't have to. It's not like if you don't believe some certain Zen tenet, then you are cursed in some way. It's you're free to explore on your own and question everything. If you find some belief, the Buddha actually recommended question it, but Zen, even within Buddhism, is really into questioning everything. Sometimes in modern Buddhism, we have this term secular Buddhism, and this Dale Wright said, Zen was the originators of secular Buddhism. The very beginnings of Zen was kind of like, could be seen as a secular Buddhist movement in its early days. He also said in this vein that Zen is like the Maserati of religions. It's sleek, it's simple, there's nothing extra, it's very fast and very smooth. But actually, it costs a lot. Which he didn't explain that, but I took that to mean like, you have to give everything to practice it fully. You have to give your life to it. But it's very simple. Nothing extra. Sixth strength is that the teachings of like, no self, no independent self, and the dependent arising of everything. And I would maybe even add in teachings of mind only, that everything we're experiencing is filtered through our individual nervous system and sensory apparatus and mind. Those teachings fit in very nicely with contemporary worldview. And I think modern science, Johnny recently gave me a book about how the brain works, that's remarkably similar to a lot of the teachings we discuss. Brain science, worldview of ecology, things like this, very nicely. I think a lot of people are drawn to Buddhism and Zen because it so nicely accords with our present understanding of the world. Seventh strength is Zen's emphasis on freedom. It's always been about finding freedom right here and now, and you know, seeing how things are, how things work, and just according with the way things are going, and finding freedom within that. Of course, all the koan stories are about finding this freedom and what Dale Wright called relaxed spontaneity. Eighth strength, and particularly in Zen, is it's a tradition of playfulness, humor, and laughter, which is quite unusual in the religious world. We have a lot of Zen jokes. You know, these koans, you know, they're very formally collected, and you know, we might take them very seriously, but there's this, you know, there's this overlay of like kind of subtle, sometimes quite subtle humor woven through the whole Zen tradition, and you know, a kind of iconoclastic streak in early Zen. It's okay to be irreverent in Zen. Ninth strength is the Zen tradition of going beyond the teacher. Many traditions probably don't have this point either, but it's one of the aspects of traditional Zen is that the student should not just equal the teacher's way of practice, but should go beyond it. In other words, it's not just duplicating a kind of static thing. It's constantly evolving. Not necessarily their understanding is deeper, but more like their individual expression of practice has to be unique to them. It's not just copying the teacher. And there's a dynamic tension here because there is a lot of deeply honoring the tradition and the teacher and all the ancestors and practicing in the same, very similar style, but it must be unique in the end. It must be the particular flavor of each individual person. And that's praised and celebrated in Zen, the creative uniqueness of each person. Tenth strength is the aesthetic sensibility of Zen. That Zen, not only all religions and spiritual traditions include art. Most art around the world has often comes from different spiritual traditions. But Zen doesn't just have like decorative art. It actually makes doing the art into practice, which is maybe a little different than even other Buddhist traditions. There's Zen, we call Zen arts, right? That are particularly in Japan, flower arranging, tea ceremony, calligraphy, many others, right? That are not just about producing an artistic product, but the activity of doing that art is itself seen as an essential Zen practice. Dale Wright did mention that we're a little bit lagging behind in the musical department in Zen. Most spiritual traditions have a little bit more music than us, but we do like our chanting. And there is actually in Zen, there's a musical tradition maybe we can try out sometime here called Goeika. 11th, final point, final strength of Soto Zen is that it has this literary tradition of stories of the Zen ancestors. So instead of just teaching like here's the practice and here's how it looks and here's the eightfold path, it's actually instead of instructions like how to do it manual, it's stories of actual people and how they lived. So we have these examples, which are sometimes very strange stories. But that's unique to Zen, and I think a strength. What does this mind of freedom look like in the world? Not just like how do you get there, and you know what's a description of it, but what's it look like through a particular person? So this Denko Roku that we'll go through this Sesshin is a collection of such stories of how these ancestors struggled and found freedom. So since we're celebrating Zen tonight, I won't spend time on the weaknesses of Soto Zen.
How many did he identify?
Less. I'll just mention them, the names. The four, and this was just, you know, this particular person's take on it. But I thought that was a nice list of strengths. The weaknesses he mentioned were the moral dimension. And he said that, you know, in modern America, we care about this a lot more. We're really into, like, the Bodhisattva precepts and talking about that and seeing how it applies, how ethics apply. But traditionally, this has not been an emphasis in the Zen tradition. So we're kind of improving this weakness in American Zen, he said. But various things, you know, Zen at wartime and... you know, there's such emphasis on emptiness in Zen that's going beyond all conventions and so on that tends to sometimes undermine ethics and morality. And we have our share of Zen scandals in America, maybe more than other traditions. So we can work on this. And in other words, the political dimension, I think that was his unique take, is that, you know, most religions are often steer clear of politics, but I think in modern times, it's a tricky area. We don't want to get totally involved in politics and taking sides and so on, and yet politics has so much to do with the suffering of the world these days, so something in there we can look at. Third is the intellectual dimension. Zen tends to be kind of like anti-intellectual traditionally. I might fall into the maybe other extreme side, so you don't have to worry about that around here. But he particularly said, you know, young people in this country and around the world want a philosophy of life. They want something that they can really, that makes sense to them. And if you just say, none of it matters, just sit. You don't need to understand anything. People want something a little more than that. And there's so much emphasis on no mind and no thinking. Thought gets kind of demonized, he says, in traditional Zen. So we have to look at that. And then the enlightened dimension was the fourth. Really emphasizing bodhicitta and going beyond our current understanding of enlightenment. Enlightenment's always been emphasized in Zen, but not falling into some static view of, and it's that it's particularly like the mind of like freedom from all constraints. You know, I think traditional Zen teaching has a lot of that, and that maybe doesn't help in like day-to-day situations. We need an enlightenment, he says, that applies to our whole life and in all realms. And an example of like a beautiful, we want to create beautiful human beings in all these dimensions, not just so that they can, when somebody asks them a question, they can slap them. I mean, that might be enlightened in some sense, but we need more than that. We need to be able to say, well, maybe instead of slapping you in the old Zen style, we can say, what do you need here, actually? And again, I think in American Zen, we don't do so much slapping anyway. So I think all of these weaknesses of traditional Soto Zen, in fact, all four are being addressed in modern Zen already. Yes. Maybe as we conclude here, could the tea servers collect the cups?
Just a quick comment that I was surprised you didn't put in there, that it seems to me that Zen, at least in this country, is non-patriarchal, or at least it's kind of grappling with that in an active way.
Yes.
And open to, you know, people of all ages, sexual orientations, etc.
Yes.
So we're trying to address that.
Yes, very much so. And some people might say that's a the kind of in Asian Buddhism and Zen, it's been very male-dominated, like most religious traditions. So we might say a weakness of traditional religion of all kinds. And but I think that's a strength of American Zen, that it's very balanced. Almost all Zen centers, equal number of men and women practicing, and it's surprising sometimes that it's something about the universality. It tends to draw everybody, independent of gender. And many women leaders and teachers around America in the Zen community. Anything else tonight? Yes.
Zen seems to have taken on the face of each country it has come to.
Yes. Yeah. This scholar Dale also mentioned kind of like points of tension that in Zen, and one of them it was kind of like how it adapts to a new culture. Buddhism always adapts to new cultures as it moves around the world, and how do we find that balance between honoring the tradition, not changing it too quickly, and yet really adapting to, we're finding our own American style of practice. And I think in many ways we have. It's very different from Japan and China and India. And yet we might also feel like, this is really weird. Why are we like chanting in Japanese and wearing Japanese stuff? And so there's some dynamic tension there, how it adapts. So I look forward to practicing with all of you through this practice period. And I have this little sense in the back of my mind that like it'll be sitting here just like this at the end of Rohatsu Sesshin in 9 weeks, and it'll be just like over like that. So let's really engage each precious moment of this period. Dedicate any merit arising from this discussion and ceremony tonight to the complete freedom filled with laughter, tears, and plainness for all beings throughout space and time. Beings are numberless.